This episode is brought to you with the support of Basic Six. Basic Six t-shirts are organic and ethically made. If you want a great t-shirt that shows you know enough about aviation and aerospace by the designs they display, then get over to basic6.co.uk. Shipped anywhere in the world, you will get a 10% discount by using the promo code EXTENDED. You can only get this discount through this promotion. So thank you to Basic Six, and join us in wearing the Aerospace to be seen in t-shirts. Go to basic6.co.uk. Enjoy the show.
This is XTP Media.
This is Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to episode 23 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. And joining to me today is my co-presenter, editor-in-chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson.
Hello, everybody.
And also joining us today is David Vanderhoof, the historian from the Airplane Geeks, co-presenter on the UAV Digest, and historian for Plane Crazy Down Under. David, welcome to Extended.
Well, this is a switch. I'm across the pond for once. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. We want to have a little chat about your background and learn a little bit more about you. But please do chip in. There's some great content in the show today. So we're absolutely delighted in having you with us. In this episode, we have a look at some news. We have an interview about the new Taranis from Tim. And I also got to speak to John Duke about the new Total Eclipse business jet. We have the next iteration of our new segment, X10R Top 10, which got some debate going from the last show, which, of course, was Tim's top seaplane. So maybe we can have a discussion about some ideas around that. We've got lots of engagement in the Get Involved segment. And of course, we have Promoting Aerospace. In amongst all of this, we will hopefully get a chance to talk a little bit more to David about his aviation background as well. But as always, let's get started by looking at what's caught our eye in aerospace news. And with so much to get through today, let's focus on what's been happening a bit closer to home. Tim, you've been to Singapore. We'd like to have a little chat about that in a moment. But events in the Ukraine are unfolding as we record, and by the time we get this to air, let's hope that things have not grown any worse than they have done. But there is the real potential here for red-on-red aggression. The Ukraine's air force is pretty small, but is made up of elements of aircraft which are identical to the Russians. What's this going to look like, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, you're right in saying that obviously Ukraine's air force is much smaller than the Russian air force, but essentially, you know, it's got the same more or less the same equipment, SU-27s, MiG-29s, you know, Frogfoots for sort of close air support, ground attack, some fences. They are, kind of outnumbered by the Russian Air Force if things do go down that way. But it has to be remembered, Ukraine has got a very, very dense and sophisticated SAM network.
Right.
And only in 2008, when the Russian Air Force, Russians, had the Georgian obviously the kind of a Georgian crisis, Georgian a war. In about 5 days of war, the Russians had about 7 aircraft shot down, and there was another 3 aircraft that were kind of written off when thinking about a base. And that was against very, very kind of light, limited air defences. And the Russians couldn't get air superiority. So, in a sense, the SAM network of, what will still be operated by, forces loyal to the centre would be the biggest obstacle, I think, for any, the Russian Air Force. However, that depends on how many of these units sort of switch sides. Then obviously the shoe could be on the other foot, and it could be a case of do Western Ukrainian what's left in Western Ukraine, do they try and get do they go up against their own SAM network in trying to support their troops on the ground, or to get their get parts of their territory back. It's a really fluid situation at the moment.
Has there ever been a situation like this where Sukhoi and MiG aircraft have been up against each other? I mean, I suppose the more modern variants, although unfortunately for Ukraine, they're pretty old.
Not the sort of latest sort of variants that the kind of Russia is really feeling, but there was, I believe it was Eritrea versus Ethiopia, had some air combat which saw, I think, flankers go up against MiG-29s. It's a very interesting jet kill there from a female pilot as well. I think it was flying for Eritrea.
David, what's your view on some of these aircraft? I mean, pretty old. When we look at the breakdown of the Ukraine Air Force, a lot of their aircraft are due for upgrade or being used for spare parts.
Yeah, I mean, they are former Soviet aircraft. I mean, they have. It was interesting the part when the Soviet Union broke up, how things were divided, and Ukraine gave up basically their whole bomber fleet, which was Tu-22Ms, and they also gave up. They had a bunch of Tu-160s, which were nuclear capable, and they gave them up and scrapped them. It'll be an interesting challenge. What is interesting about it is a lot of the military aircraft are in the Crimea area, because the Crimea, from a Soviet standpoint, Cold War standpoint, was very much a super naval base / military complex that the Soviets needed to get into the Black Sea, which is their only warm water port. So you can imagine that a lot of those aircraft, we'll see if they're flying out, but I think this is with 5 Illusions coming in with extra military people out of the one really large military airport in Sevastopol. Basically, some of their good hardware is going to get locked down by the Soviets and won't even get airborne because the Russians are building such an infrastructure. It's like the good old days of the Cold War. When I was studying military history and diplomacy back in college, it was, we war gamed this stuff out, and the first thing I did was block the Bosphorus and then send a bunch of ships up and wipe out the Black Sea Fleet, because it was the winter we were playing in, so that would take out basically the Russian Navy. So Russia does not ever want to lose that warm water port, and It's their connection to the Mediterranean. It's their correct connection to basically that whole European area. When in the dead of winter, you have the North Sea ports are frozen over, and on the west side, they're frozen over. So they're not going to give up lightly on this.
Okay. Well, let's move on then to something slightly more positive in the news. Tim, you're recently back from Singapore. We obviously saw some of the big stories break in there. But I think it was intriguing. There wasn't much coverage, really, of the 787 versus the A350, which we talked about prior to you leaving.
Yeah, I mean, the Singapore air show was full of news. There's some interesting stuff going on. It was the first air show where you had both the 787 and the A350 down on the ground at the same time, for people to kind of look around and compare and contrast. A350 did the flying display.
From all accounts, it was quite an impressive display as well.
It was, yeah. And, only this week there was Airbus Group announcements, and they got two prototypes, MSN2 and MSN4, airborne on the same day. So really, their test program, they've learned from A380, they've learned also from 787. The test program is really kind of going great guns, in terms of meeting the targets, hitting the sort of schedule. There were some estimates saying that every schedule will have extra time built in, but they're really on track for delivering the first aircraft to Qatar Airways, even a little bit ahead of time. So that's pretty good, unless something really unexpected comes out of the blue, and we've had that before. They haven't had all the problems that the 787 hit. So really encouraging stuff.
And also, there were some developments on low-cost airlines. You talked about aircraft types and types of aircraft changing from small narrow-body jets to turboprops.
Well, we've had these big mega orders from people like AirAsia, Lion Air. Some of them are now looking a little bit like they were over optimistic. But one of the interesting stories to come out of Singapore was airlines like Knock Air from Thailand, who is buying only a couple of Q400s, but ultra dense configuration. And their plan is really to kind of take low cost budget carriers to places of in Asia Pacific that really hadn't been served. So they're thinking sort of secondary airports, tertiary airports, all these sort of cities around there, and really kind of grow that way rather than buying a whole load of bigger aircraft and then being stuck because you're only going into a limited number of airports and you haven't got enough pilots, etc. So a little bit of sort of an interesting strategy. Opposite to what say AirAsia and Lion Air are doing, where they're just going head first into growth. Obviously the other big story coming out of Asia Pacific was until this week, it was seen as a potential flashpoint. We've got the Chinese air defense zone, people getting very worried about there, so that was driving defense defense expenditure, and people are kind of thinking about upgrading their fighter fleets, updating their air forces. F-16 upgrades is a big kind of was a big story of the show. Lockheed Martin now being up against Beer Systems in terms of offering an upgrade for kind of older F-16s, older Vipers.
And what countries are looking for this upgrade, Tim?
Korea's already plumbed for the Beer Systems upgrade.
Right.
Taiwan is also looking at it. They were supposed to be linked with the US, a US sort of midlife upgrade for their F-16s. Bit of uncertainty now about the USAF upgrade. So you've got Taiwan. There's also Singapore itself that was looking out for them. So all these kind of F-16, possibly Indonesia, maybe. Although I think they're now looking at some other aircraft. But all these countries that have got slightly older F-16s, and the fact that the F-35 is sort of delayed, you know, that's causing countries like Singapore to think, okay, actually we need to, invest and get a bit more of an upgrade to our Vipers to just make them last longer.
And what about the US F-16s, David? What sort of upgrades are they going through then?
Not much, because all the money's going into the F-35. It's definitely a challenge that the only saving grace is you can say that we have more F-16s than we know what to do with. But with sequestration, a lot of the units are disbanding, and basically we're sending them off to the mothballs.
Yeah.
So and of course we have the luxury to have, we have enough F-16s that we can convert them to drones and blow them up ourselves. So here in the States, which most countries don't have, but yeah, it's going to be scavenging for parts, and the Air Force doesn't want to spend lots and lots of money on F-16s when they want F-35s.
Yeah.
So I'm sure we'll be doing a lot of cannibalization, and you know, as we keep downsizing, we'll have more aircraft than we know what to do with. And worst comes to worst, you just blow them up with Sidewinders and Sparrows and air-to-ground missiles. So we're in a unique situation. F-16s are going to be around a long time, but we're not, and we don't have the most advanced F-16s. If you think about the Echoes and the Foxtrots, the E's and F's, that are in some other nations, our F-16s are a lot older than a lot of those. So,
yeah.
And most of the production line now goes to overseas. Hardly any come to the United States.
Yeah. Okay, and where does the F-22 sit in the mix?
We got approximately 120 of them, and that's it. We're consolidating them into specific units. There's the Hawaiian unit, Virginia, where First TAC Fighter Wing is, and down in Eglin, but there's a finite amount of those. So
yeah.
if we lose one, for whatever reason, it's like the situation we have with like B-1s. You know, the number doesn't ever go up. It goes down. Lockheed did spare the line, and they supposedly can rebuild it any time, but I don't ever see that happening.
The USAF's been doing some work for deploying F-22s over the Pacific called something called Rapid Raptor. Basically, they realized that these super bases like Guam, or Kadena in Japan would be are immensely vulnerable. You know, you've got all the tankers there, you've got all the ISR aircraft, you've got all the F-22s all in one place, which is just basically inviting your enemy to go and cover it with missiles in the first sort of minutes, if not hours, of war. So what they're now looking at is parceling out these deploying the kind of F-22s in sort of like packages of four. Across the Pacific, and making them much more survivable. It's a bit almost like a sort of 21st century idea of the Harrier hides. You know, obviously they're not going to be in a sort of like a hide like a Harrier, but it's complicating the enemy sort of targeting challenge and making sure that some would survive.
Well, yeah, I mean it's all we're back to pre-positioning assets, but not necessarily the actual asset, but the supporting equipment. In Desert Storm, in 1991, the First TAC Fighter Wing deployed to Saudi Arabia. When they got there, basically we had built a rapid reaction base in Saudi Arabia that could support the aircraft. The only thing that was missing really was the aircraft. So as we deploy in a sequestration in a post-Cold War, Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, we're going to have to start doing more of this kind of pre-positioning, or it's everybody for themselves, and we're not going to be the front line like we were in 1991, where within 24 hours, we actually were landing aircraft and flying combat air patrols over a hostile nation. That's just not going to happen anymore.
Yeah. Well, on that note, let's leave the news there. And after the break, we'll talk to David about how he became an aviation historian.
10-10-10, KLM-691, and we have a low fuel emergency for our diversion to Syracuse. Declaring a low fuel emergency, KLM-691.
KLM-691, Roger. Direct to Syracuse, maintain 5,000.
Direct Syracuse, maintain 5,000, KLM-691.
KLM-691, heavy, say souls on board.
Souls on board is 443, KLM-691.
Roger, 443.
Charlie, KLM-691.
Hi, this is Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Each week we bring you Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment covering European aviation. Check us out at airplanegeeks.com. Until then, enjoy Extended.
So, David, a historian, you mentioned the studies you undertook earlier in the show. How did you get to be the military expert and historian for the Airplane Geeks? How did it all start?
Well, you could say that I grew up with airplanes in my blood. But how it started at Airplane Geeks was, simply put, I wrote a letter. I sent an email. I started listening to podcasts and found Airplane Geeks. And at the time, Courtney and Max, and this is dating itself, were looking for suggestions. So I said, oh, well, what they need is a history segment. So I wrote them a letter with an example of what I was thinking they needed to do so I could listen to it. And next thing you know, I get an email from Max saying, great, when do you start? okay. So from there, it was writing the segments, having the guys read them, and then eventually Dan and Rob got sick of reading them.
Yeah.
So they said, why don't you come on and read your stories? I'm like, okay. So I did my history segment, and then suddenly I was guest hosting, and suddenly, you know, it was from there. So
There's a lot more to it than that. You've written, 200-300 odd history segments. That's an awful lot of information that you've got in your head. Tell us a little bit about your love for the C-130 and your father and how you got involved in aviation that way.
Well, I have to thank a failure of Lockheed to make a budget. My father actually was at an engineer at a Army base, Fort Dix, over in New Jersey, and he actually got bumped from his job because a civil engineer who was being laid off from the Lockheed Cheyenne helicopter project caused my father to have to go find another job, which he was selected to become base civil engineer for the 913th, at that time, Tactical Airlift Squadron over in Pennsylvania at Willow Grove. Unfortunately, I can't say the base exists anymore or the squadron, but my father at the time in 1971 was chartered with closing the base, and they had just shipped off the squadron's C-130s to Vietnam to support the South Vietnamese Air Force. They revised the base and revised the mission, and the squadron got a fairly new C-130Es. So, as much as I have my father to thank for the environment, I got to give my mother all the credit because she was she actually put up with a little kid that wanted to go down and look at dad's airplanes. You know, we had a school field trip, and I thought it was really cool that we were taking everybody at school in first grade to look at dad's airplanes, because, you know, dad's airplanes flew when I wanted to see them. And I was kind of privileged. I grew up, and nothing better than my father and my mother would take my father to lunch. This is, and basically he'd take me downstairs to a big old Coca-Cola bottle machine where you had to actually, it had the built-in bottle opener. So he'd get me a Coke, and I'd sit on the porch and I'd watch all the airplanes go by as he and my mother would have lunch.
And you know, what sort of aircraft were you watching then, David?
Well, we at Willow Grove, it was kind of nice because Willow Grove was at the time the largest reserve base in the world for the United States military. We had C-130s from the Air Force Reserve. We had Cessna O-2s or Cessna Skymasters from the Pennsylvania Air National Guard. I had A-4Es and Fs and TA-4Js for the United States Marine Corps. The Navy had two squadrons of P-3s and a C-118 Douglas DC-6s. And the Army had a bunch of Hueys that they would fly. So I got to watch all of that stuff come and go. And then every 4th of July, we had one of the largest air shows in North America where I would get things like Vulcan bombers, the Canadian Snowbirds, the Blue Angels, B-52s, you know, C-5s. One of the funny stories I always tell everybody, and you don't do this anymore, was my father used to tell me, if I ever get lost, go to the big airplane with the mouth opened and the tail open, and I'll find you. So that was my lost child thing, was a C-5. So I grew up around all these aircraft. My house was at the end of the flight line, so if anything flew north, I would have aircraft flying over all the time. And I had very much a family life that supported me liking airplanes.
Oh, yeah.
My mother could tell the difference between a P-3 and a C-130 sitting in the living room by what was flying over by sound. She didn't even need to look. The original intent was, flash forward to when I was 18, was I signed up to join the United States Air Force and was going to be a loadmaster on guess what airplane. Unfortunately, my second physical, they diagnosed me with asthma, so that didn't happen. So I went back to college, got my degree in military history and diplomacy. My background was on Arab-Israeli conflicts or World War II German Luftwaffe. So it's kind of an odd combination, but if you think about it, a lot of the Israeli aircraft in the 1940s were World War II German Luftwaffe. So there is a connection there. So, and fast forward, there's no money in aviation history, so I got a job as a marketer. So there, I do have a day job where that doesn't necessarily involve airplanes. So if there's an accident or an incident or something, sure enough, everybody's at my desk asking me what happened. But I guess that's the price you have to pay for being, quote, an expert.
Now, you're surrounded, talking to us now, you're surrounded by models. You're a very keen aviation modeler as well.
Yeah, let's say, to set the stage, I'm staring at a very large lithograph of an F-119. But directly above my head, I have an AC-47 gunship, a JU-52 on floats, a MD-80, the actual aircraft my wife and I flew on our honeymoon, down to the November number. I have an Adolf Galen print, a Eric Hartman print signed by both, and lots of models. Just so you know, I'm not an Americaphobe. I have... most of my models are actually German Luftwaffe, but I do have a Sea Hurricane, and I have a Hawk Mark I, as well as some Israeli aircraft and some couple of Harriers, and of course, one of my all-time favorite airplanes, the BV-141, if anybody knows what that is. So,
Tim, there's a test for you. I don't.
it's the one that looks like somebody did put the instructions to the kit on kind of wrong, yeah.
Asymmetric aircraft, yeah, and I have a lot of my pictures hanging up as well. So
you've also got a bit of a real aircraft in your den as well, haven't you?
Oh, you're talking about my little piece of hardware, that tail hook from yes. an A4 Skyhawk.
How the hell did you get that?
Well, it was given to me by I had a tech rep from the base who became a very good friend and a lifelong friend, and when we were retiring, when VMFA 131 was retiring the Skyhawks, this one was carrier qualified, et cetera, but they have a service life, you know, and you don't really want a tail hook from a Skyhawk breaking as the airplane's landing on an aircraft carrier, or in the case of the Marines, field arresting gear. So I got it, and I'm lucky, you know. I have a wife that allows me to keep a tail hook, and she does, as she said in the past, there are times that what she really doesn't understand is, she understands me having the tail hook. What she really doesn't understand is the other people who come to the house who want their picture taken with the tail hook. So it's a running tradition that if you visit us and you're an AV geek, you get your picture taken with the tail hook. So
I'm presuming the problem would be is if the tail hook started kind of getting friends, like you know, bits of landing gear, flaps, and you know, she came in one day and there was an actual, you know, A4 sitting there, you know, ready to.
Yeah, we used to joke with my friend the tech rep that he was taking parts home, and you know, we were going to go in his backyard at one point and see a full A4M. In there, but yeah, so a couple of us got the tail hooks, and it's a unique piece of hardware to go with the geekdom, I guess.
Well, David, thank you very much for that. One of the other programs that you, of course, you are involved in is the UAV Digest. So the next item may be of real interest to you. After this break, Tim gets to talk to Bob Fraser about flying the Taranis.
Turkish 6329 on out, second to the right, Hotel 2, thank you.
Second to the right, Hotel 2, Turkish 6329, welcome. Runway located, 6329.
Thank you, apron 121.850.
Apron 121.850, Turkish 6329, good day. Tower, Turkish 6329, with you again, approaching runway 28.
Turkish 6329, hello again, on taxiway Juliet, cross runway 28, connect apron 121.750, bye-bye.
On Juliet, cross runway 28, and 121.750, Turkish 6329, bye-bye.
I'm here with Bob Fraser from BAE Systems, who is the Taranis test pilot.
Well, I'm the project pilot, and I was commander for the first flight of Taranis.
Now, it's exciting stuff. It's probably the most advanced military warplane that the UK has developed. Is that right?
I think it's in this particular area of air power. Yes, it is the most advanced aircraft we've produced. So, yes. It was exciting. Come back to your first point. It was very exciting. It was also very routine because we had rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. And it flew exactly as the rehearsals. So whilst I was also very excited, it was also felt like a bit of an anticlimax because it all worked perfectly.
What was the control station set up like? Is it kind of like a ground or a mouse and a sort of a computer?
No, it's just a series of data screens. We have a separate pilot who is there to intervene should the need arise. Because the aircraft flies automatically most of the time. We had a team of 10. On top of that, there was our chief engineer and also the range safety officer. So a total of 12 in the ground control station. Five of them were purely monitoring the information that came back, and the other five, including myself, were there to actually run the aircraft, if you like. So it was very much like an office, really, with a window out over the airfield.
was the biggest surprise that came up during testing? Was there anything that kind of...
Well, the biggest surprise to me, because I've been involved in other programs, is how well this aircraft flew. And I'm not just saying that. Aerodynamically, it was absolutely sound. It was very crisp in its pitching and in roll. Speed control was excellent. It got airborne exactly where he expected to get airborne. It landed exactly where he expected it to land. And so in many ways, it was, as I said before, routine. And so there was no major excitement other than the fact, of course, this thing, which looks a little space age, got airborne and came back.
And what's your background on the rest of sort of BAE's sort of manned and unmanned sort of programs?
Well, I joined BAE Systems in 2000, and then I flew the ATP. I fly the 146 at the moment. I'm a Jetstream 31 pilot and also the Astraea program commander for that as well. I also fly the PA-44 and occasionally the Diamond Twin. But on the unmanned side, I'm a pilot commander for Hertie. I was a pilot for most of the flights of Mantis, and here I find myself in Taranis.
Okay. And was there much sort of read across from Taranis to Hertie, and also Astraea as well, in terms of the systems?
Take the last one first. Astraea, nothing. Because Astraea is looking at a completely different side of the house, if you like. As far as Mantis and Hertie concerned, Hertie is a much slower, much simpler aeroplane. But there was some read across from Mantis, because really the lessons learnt on Mantis. I was alluding to one of your colleagues earlier, that on first flight of Mantis, it seemed to have a Dutch roll problem, which we were very concerned about at the time. Having said that, it wasn't a Dutch roll problem. Our outer control loops were over-controlling the inner control loops. So it was trying very, very hard to stay exactly on track. And that gave us the of an aerodynamic fault. It was no aerodynamic fault. So there were those sort of lessons that we learned from Taranis. Let's not try to keep it within an inch of its track. You know, a few feet of its track is fine. And when you do that, everything smooths down and it all becomes very straightforward. So... There were lessons learned from other programs, yes. There wasn't a huge amount of technology read across, except I suppose some of our control systems are, you just tell it the different parameters to fit in. So some of that aspect was read across.
And I presume you were involved in the slow speed taxi tests as well at Wharton.
I was commander for all of it, yes.
So how did you keep those sort of secret from people peeking over the fence?
We had a security plan. There was a chap who appeared at the fence, which caused us alarm. He did have a camera, so that was most concerning. But we just stopped if we thought there was someone peering through the fence that we didn't really want to be there. But surprisingly, very little activity.
I just need to grab Bob to have 2 minutes with the BBC and then we'll bring him back. Is that okay?
Yeah, just one more question. Final question would be, is this over now for flight tests for Taranis, or is it going into that?
Well, I think what Nigel stated was there were a number of phases to this programme. We have completed one of the phases. There's a discussion with the MOD about what we do next. And each phase builds on the previous phase. So I'm not in a position to tell you what we're going to do next, but there are discussions about what we'll be doing next.
Thanks very much.
Tim, great interview. Really interesting. He talks as if he was actually flying that aircraft. I know he was, but it feels like he was in it.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's an experienced test pilot anyway, but it's kind of, sort of a project pilot stroke mission commander. You know, he sat there in front of a screen. He's got sort of, basically sort of says, he's there looking out on the airfield and with, sort of a team of 12. But he's essentially doing the sort of same job as a test pilot sat in the aircraft. But the difference is you're trying to kind of interpret what is happening to the air vehicle while you're not in it. So maybe it's kind of an interesting evolution of the test pilot's job.
But the way he talked about the aerodynamics of the aircraft, and why shouldn't he, of course, but he talked very competently about the feel of it. It was really like he could feel it.
Well, I think that's what the experienced and the highly trained sort of test pilot brings to it. You know, if you've got that much experience, if you've been through the test pilot schools, if you've flown the real aircraft, you know, then you are familiar enough, and you know to see the data and to work out, oh yeah, it's doing that in the air, or it's performing that maneuver, and you've got that kind of sort of innate sort of sense or experience to kind of to draw on your own, you know, sort of test pilot career to say, well, you know, I'm not in it, but this is what it's doing, and this is you know how it's performing.
Yeah.
But you know, very exciting stuff. You know, this is the guy who's the most advanced you know military aerospace project in the UK at the moment. Real sort of you know, they've kept it so classified up to this point, in that you could get pictures of, you know, sort of Chinese sort of UCAVs. You know, people were like putting that on the web. There was the X-47B Neuron was flying. No pictures almost whatsoever of, you know, first flight of Tronis.
Yeah.
Now it's opened up. It's not opened up completely. They're still very, very, very cagey about it, what it can actually do, which some people sort of suspect, well, you know, maybe it is a sort of a step beyond the opposition. Well, not the opposition, but the competition. Well, I'd be interested to what you think of it, David.
That's a tough call. It's interesting, Tim, that you're saying that the security actually was because of the proprietary technology and not just the mission. Clearly it was tested down in Australia, because you can clearly see the the environment in which it was tested. It's everyone, the UAVs is a, as far as military UAVs go, it's a tight net race, and Great Britain is definitely trying to play catch up with the Israelis. I mean, they're at the top of the lead with the U.S. And a multi-mission stealth UAV is going to be a game changer. And how do you integrate that in with you integrate that with your Air Force? We sort of have built our own little Air Force with Reapers and Predators. The X-47B or the next variant of it will be interesting how it's integrated. But it's everyone's trying to play catch up. Now, you notice I left out the Chinese, because I'm not quite convinced that, yeah, they're flying these things that look like Taranis or the X-47B, but we really don't know what's inside of them. I mean, you talk about the electronics, and yes, the aerodynamics they're catching up with, but are they really viable aircraft? Or, you know, I mean, it is kind of, I jokingly say that it is kind of funny that, you know, when a top secret test shows up, suddenly all of the Chinese press are there to take pictures of it. Whereas in the case of Taranis, it was almost 6 months that British BAE released the information that it had first flown. So where's the secrecy there? But it's, we talk about a lot on UAV Digest about, we try to stay, I actually do try to stay away from the military aspects, because there's so much growth there. But, and the challenge is, I guess, proprietary. You know, Taranis is a next generation stealth combat air vehicle. So it'll be interesting how it gets incorporated into the RAF and how quickly that will be moving to next stages.
Well, it's only a technology sort of demonstrator at the moment, and I think the thing is for Taranis and for Neuron and for X-47B, you know, great capability and brings new things, but they're a very, very niche capability. It's not everyone's going to be able to afford them. They're not going to be procured, I don't think, in huge numbers. So But I think there is room. I think also that the expanding sort of civil market, you know, civil market we've seen so far has been, you know, the multi rotors, the small things, you know, you know, will get great pictures for YouTube or for sort of TV, but they've got a battery life of what, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes tops. So maybe there is a big niche that everyone is missing is what is going to be the civil version of the Predator. You know, what is going to be that thing that you know, you could have as a well, you know, sort of a search aircraft from a sort of maritime patrol that would do kind of police type roles, or you could set it off and it could go and do you know, kind of firefighting. It could look for firefighting, you know, forest firefighting at night, those sort of things. You know, probably kind of or perhaps even cargo. You know, could go and do sort of like to ship cargo around. It's interesting.
Yeah, the mail or medium altitude, long endurance, which is your Predators, your Reapers, those aircraft that provide multi-mission. Well, here in the United States, we have a problem. You can't commercially fly a UAV because the Federal Aviation Administration doesn't allow it. We talk about this a lot on UAV Digest.
I think it's the most talked about thing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I jokingly said we needed to start a drinking game. You know, every time we say the word FAA, everybody does a shot. Unfortunately, our listeners will be won't remember anything Max and I have said, but all of these, there's so much potential in this industry. It's only a year ago that I jokingly had said to our listeners on Airplane Geeks that, you know, would you listen, because we were talking about UAVs, would you listen to a UAV podcast? And Max immediately after that episode emailed me and said, are you serious about this? And I'm like, I don't know. And we just recorded our 28th episode, and it's going like hotcakes. And there's never it's not like we ever don't have enough to talk about. There's every week we have a new thing about, and it's so explosive. In a way, the U.S. is sort of lagging behind. Great Britain came out. You guys came out with two test centers before we even announced our six. Australia has got regulations in about commercial uses, and it's the growth for aviation. We're not going to not stop talking about it, and slowly we're seeing the words drone change. You know, for the first couple of episodes, we wouldn't use the word drone; we would use the word UAS or UAV. Because drone had such a negative connotation. Over the last couple of weeks, we've started seeing the mainstream media realize that not every article about a drone requires a picture of a Reaper or a Predator. You know, when you talk about a drone delivering something, you don't really want to put a picture of a Reaper firing a HARM. It just doesn't send the right message. And I think that turning point was Mr. Bezos in Amazon. It may have been the world's greatest publicity stunt, but it has sort of turned the tide of the tone. You know, we're now talking about UAVs and UASs in a lot of new variants where it's a positive thing, not just foreign countries where some guy is sitting in a box in Arizona and flying it in over Afghanistan and blowing up things that most people don't even know exist. So it's clearly where the future's going. But and Europe is a bit ahead of the curve. Well, at least Great Britain. It's hard to say what the other countries are doing, but it will be, we're all going to be inundated with drone stories, I think, for the next 15, 20 years.
I think that's the exciting thing about it, is it's kind of like the pioneering, you know, early days of sort of aviation, you know, in the kind of Wright Brothers era no one quite knows where it's going to go. And, you know, the regulators are sort of struggling to kind of keep up, you know, what is it in the end thing going to be look like? You know, no one's not quite sure.
And Max sort of likens it to the PC or computer age that we went through 20 years ago, where everybody's open for, you can't do that. Everything's wide open, and we're going to discover uses for UAVs that we didn't even know we can't even think about. Because if you told somebody 20 years ago, or when I was back in college, that I would be talking on a computer and having a conversation with Europe on a regular basis, or having Australia call me on my phone on a regular basis, I would have told you were nuts. But my phone has got more computing power than I think all of the computers I used in college. So we don't know what's going to happen, but it's going to be big.
So, David, just to wrap this segment up, where can we find out a little bit more about the UAV Digest?
The podcast comes out every Friday morning. It's a quick listen to. It's only 30 minutes. Max and I either do all news or we have a guest. It's a very simple show, but you can find it at theuavdigest.com. Or you can go to our Facebook page, which is UAV Digest, or on Twitter, look for UAV Digest, at UAV Digest. So we're around, or you can go to airplanegeeks.net and jump off there where you...
Excellent. So now a first for Extended. It's our first flight review. John Duke from Get Into Flying got to fly the new Eclipse, the twin-engine bizjet, through the European distributor of the aircraft. That's Aeris Aviation. John, welcome back on Extended.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, you're a great supporter of the show, and of course our resident pilot, and today we get to talk about what I think is our first flight review, and you got the opportunity to fly on the new Eclipse.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've been in touch with the guys over at Aeris Aviation, based out of Dunk as well. And they were kind enough to invite me over to fly the jet up from Newquay, and we visited Kemble for a fly to help event there.
Yeah.
And then we flew back to Dunk as well.
Well, we know through Get Into Fly, and you've got quite a rich vein of aviation flowing through you, but you're normally to be found in rotary winged aircraft. Have you ever flown a bizjet before?
I've never flown a bizjet, no. I've flown quite a wide range of fixed wing aircraft.
Yeah.
Obviously, my previous RAF sort of vintage was... I flew the Tucano for several hours, and I've flown everything from aerobatic aircraft up to six-seater single-engine pistons. But this was the first time that I've flown anything privately owned with a turbine, and it was certainly the first time that I'd flown a bizjet or anything with more than one engine. So it was very exciting.
Well, let's talk through the process then. She's certainly pretty. And a lovely piece of engineering. The walk around, you talk in the blog when you wrote this up, that it was a really quick walk around. Is that normal for an aircraft like this? Because I would have thought there'd been a fair bit of a walk around.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly I imagine that business jets, this is the only experience I have of flying a business jet, so I can't necessarily say that it's a faster walk around than alternatives, but it strikes me that they are designed to be fairly rapid to get around and to get into the air because of the sort of clientele that you're looking at.
Yeah.
Having flown a larger piston aircraft, I would say it was just as quick, you know, to walk around as something like a Piper Lance or a Seneca or something of that size.
Yeah.
You've obviously got two engines, but the only real inspection points on the aircraft were to take the various sort of covers off the pitot-static system and off the engines, and a bog standard walk around, make sure she's not leaking or the tires aren't flat.
Yeah.
Check the oil levels in the engine, and that was pretty much it. The thing that really impressed me was just how simple and how elegantly the aircraft was sort of prepared for flight. The tow bar stowed away quite nicely in the cabin itself, and everything had its place. You know, you weren't cluttering up the baggage area with all the extras that go on the aircraft while it's in the hangar or out on the stand. So that was really nice to see, a very clean interior even after you put everything away.
Well, let's talk about coming from the outside in. Coming into the cabin, what's it feel like? What's it look like? I think most of us are unfamiliar with the with BizJet etiquette. What did it look like? How was it kitted out?
The cabin, the configuration that I saw it in had obviously the two crew seats up front, the right and left hand pilot seats, and then down the back it was fitted for three in the configuration that I saw. But again, the fourth seat was stowed neatly away in the baggage compartment, and all the seats were facing forward. I understand that you can change it into a club seating arrangement if you wish, but Aris might want to comment on how possible that is. In terms of size, it wasn't huge. It's not a gigantic aircraft, but I never felt cramped, even
because quite a tall chap, aren't you?
I'm around 6 foot, maybe slightly over 6 foot. So yeah. I'm probably fairly representative. I'm certainly not the tallest, but I would notice if it were a cramped environment.
Yeah.
But even the pilot seats just felt comfortable. Looking back, I did have a chance to sit down the back later on. There was certainly plenty of leg room, plenty of room to stretch out, and the trim and the finish, it wasn't sort of opulent luxury in terms of, it wasn't overstated and flashy. It was just really nice, almost like a luxury automobile.
Yeah.
It just had that feeling of everything fitted together, everything worked. There wasn't any fiddling around trying to, for example, the door. When we close the door so often in airplanes with doors, especially from my sort of private flying, having flown Cessnas and things like that, it's a real, you've got to get the door shut.
You're
in a certain way, all the aircraft have a different way of
good fast. Slam.
Yeah,
double
this thing,
lock.
Just click, turn the catch, and it was shut, sealed. It was just not, and that really sums up the whole aircraft, really.
Yeah, and
clicked.
Let's go into the pointy end then, and the cockpit. It's relatively simple. It's very modern, very electronic screens, drive almost everything. What did it feel like to you?
New would be in more than one sense. It felt like a new airplane. It's not actually a brand new airplane. It's a reconditioned. Eclipse, the company, they have a long history. The aircraft has been in development for a long time, but the one that I flew was a total Eclipse, which is essentially a reconditioned original design. The new ones will be slightly different, and they'll have different upgrades. But it felt new from that perspective, in terms of it felt like a new airplane, but it felt new to me because, of course, it's a glass cockpit.
Yeah.
So I'm certainly, from my day job and from all the flying that I've done today, I'm very much a steam instrument guy. I've never flown anything with a glass cockpit before. So this was it was quite strange to get into a machine, to sit in a pilot seat, and to just be confronted with, a black screen and nothing on it. Of course, once you power it up, it all comes to life. I felt very, very slick, very simple to operate. Another new thing for me was the FADEC, the full authority digital engine control.
Yeah.
One simple click to start the engine. You can barely tell it's running once it's up, unless you obviously got the instruments in front of you, but in terms of sound, you can barely tell the engine's going. Just click, start, done. And the aircraft takes care of itself. The thing that really impressed me, though, was the aircraft does its own weight and balance calculations. You just plug the numbers in. Comes up with a little graph, right, you're here, you're going to burn fuel down to this point, amazing, really nicely high-tech, but not, it was still intuitive, it wasn't, I didn't feel like I would have struggled, to walk the aircraft. I don't get the impression that you would need very much training in the actual avionics in order to become really familiar with them. It was very, it felt different to the avionics that I've seen in the past, which require a lot of sort of button turning. There were a lot of hard keys, which I like, you know, a lot of keys which don't change the functionality. Everything was clearly labeled. It just, yeah, it was intuitive. It was, you know what, if Apple made an aircraft, certainly if they made avionics, it would be very similar to this, I'm sure.
Right, okay. And the Clips is designed for and approved for single pilot as well, isn't it?
So I understand. And yeah, I'm not super swept up on the certification. I know it's still going through the certification sort of timeline. But yeah, certainly at the moment, the aircraft that Aeris have is operated on the November registration.
Yeah.
And they operate at single pilot all the time. And, you know, we talked about this in the air. It's easy to see how operating an aircraft like that, you know, it's a rapid aircraft, you know, it doesn't hang around.
Yeah.
Easy to see how that would quickly get away from someone. But the avionics really do give you good situational awareness. When we joined, actually, at Kemble, we had a really busy circuit. We were joining two arriving, two departing, one in the circuit, and we're joining, you know, high energy.
Yeah.
But it really, it was really nice to just have that picture on the primary flight display. It gave you so much more situational awareness about where you were in terms of the general pattern, but also where everybody else was. You know, and the machine's calling traffic to you as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So certainly, single pilot, it's going to be a step up for sure. But from somebody who's flown a Cirrus or something like that, I don't think it would be too much of a stretch to get into this thing and, you know, brief course. And they're going to be away.
And the pilot that you flew with, he did fly in manual mode as well on occasion. How did he describe that?
Yeah, David, the chap who was flying me, he's the chief pilot with Aeris. He flew the majority of... we got established in the descent using the automation just to prove the system and to show me the capability. But we flew the rest of the approach to Kemble and flown, and you know the aircraft didn't seem to mind at all. It was very smooth, and there was no real. You know, obviously, it's a step up moving from the automation to hand flying in terms of you know you're now using up some of your capacity to fly the aircraft.
Sure,
but it didn't seem to me to present any vice that was really going to challenge you know the average pilot. You know we weren't kind of constantly tweaking the throttles to avoid overspeeding or really worried about, well, you know, how are we going to deploy the flaps and where are we? I was quite concerned about the descent because I thought we're going awfully quickly here.
Yeah.
We're not giving ourselves a great deal of time. And I just felt that, especially with the aircraft being so quick and the acceleration out of Newquay, that it was going to be a struggle to slow it down.
Yeah.
But we just closed the throttles and it slowed right up. You know, we got the flaps down. I'm not sure what the limiting speed is, but it seemed pretty quick to me.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just a nice controlled join and approach. It never seemed to get away from the pilot whatsoever. I mean, granted, we're talking about you know, a guy with plenty of experience flying the aircraft. But even for me, although I didn't actually get hands on the stick and pedals, it was all most aircraft in my experience fly, you know, broadly the same. I mean, the controls do the same thing. You're able to get a certain feel for how the aircraft's going to fly. There was no sort of oscillations in pitch. There was no real feel of the aircraft being, you know, squirrely as we slowed down or difficult in the circuit. It just, you know, it was like it was on rails really, and it was a fairly bumpy day, you know. So I would say, although I haven't handled it, it didn't seem to present any great problems at all.
And let's just talk about the automation. I know you've commented on some of the issues in the press really recently regarding piloting skills relating to automation. What does this really mean for the potential Eclipse pilot? Because they've got quite an innovative conversion course, haven't they?
They have. Yeah, my understanding is that if you go over to the States to fly, you know, to become type rated, essentially, to do the conversion, you will, as part of that, fly an aerobatic course in an extra and do an advanced or unusual attitude course. Call it what you will. Some people call it upset recovery training, whatever. So that is.
It's quite unique, isn't it? I don't think it is.
I'm not aware of anybody else who mandates that you do that training as part of a conversion, but I'm very glad to see it in there because it is a high performance aircraft. For sure, you know, there's a potential that it's going to get away from you and you're never going to air about the thing. But you know what? There's always the chance that you could end up, you know, you get distracted, the automation, it's a, albeit very intuitive, it's a complex system.
Yeah.
And we've had incidents recently with, in particular, the Cirrus incident, where the chap ended up deploying the ballistic parachute recovery.
Yeah.
You know, there's always the chance that the aircraft's going to do something that you're not really expecting. You're going to end up in that position where you have to use those hands-on skills, and you need an aircraft that's capable of flying those maneuvers to train in. And I'm really not, I'm glad to see that Cirrus are taking a pragmatic approach and getting people to go through that training, because although it's still a small aircraft, you know, it's a jet, it's going to get, if things going wrong and it's getting away from you, it's going to happen really quickly. If you've got the confidence to just disconnect the autopilot and say, right, I know how to hand fly this thing, let's get all the other stuff out of the way, so there's definitely whatever's going on, it's not the autopilot playing tricks on me. You know, if you've got the those skills hardwired into you, that's a big plus. It's great to see Eclipse taking that line.
Really is. So the aircraft has come to ground. What's your overall impression of it?
Slick. Yeah, I was really impressed. Just little details from an operating perspective. You know, I don't have a great deal of experience operating aircraft like this, but I think it works on two levels. It works for an air taxi operator in the sense that it's a very quick turnaround time. You know, I talked about the walk around and the else. The engines are a proven power plant. You know, they don't burn a great deal of oil. You know, it's a slick operation, comfy, and it's comfortable to fly, and you can operate it single pilot, so you're not going to pay a huge amount for the crew. For somebody who is thinking about, you know, for example, somebody who's a high net worth individual who's looking at a faster way of getting from A to B, it's going to be a natural follow-on for something like a Cirrus. They've got experience flying a Cirrus. They're going to have a little bit of experience of automation. They're going to have the glass cockpit experience. Add the extra engine, you know, the turbine, and the performance to go up to 41,000 feet. And, you know, it's going to be, okay, it's going to be a step up. They're going to be ready for it. The aircraft's not going to be playing tricks on them. And in terms of operating it as a VIP aircraft, you know, I think it works as well. You only need a single pilot. You've got enough room in the back there to make someone's, you know, life comfortable while you're taking them from A to B in an aircraft that's small enough to get into some really tight strips. You know, they're not going to have to go through the big regional airports and the Gulf Stream or even in the Citation. They can get into places like Dunkerswell. Dunkerswell is like an 800 meter runway, and with the addition of the anti-skid brakes that are going to be added on the 550, the Eclipse 550, is going to be upgraded to include auto-throttle and anti-skid brakes. That's going to shorten that landing distance again. So you're going to be able to get into really, really tight runways, you know, in secluded parts of Europe. For the business operator, it works. They're saving time that they would have been spending in the queue at the airports. And for the private individual, whose time is valuable to them because they're a high net worth individual, it works again. They can get from, you know, around London or up either Edinburgh, Bristol, wherever. They can get down to the Alps. They can be on the slopes with their family inside of 3 hours, you know, and that is just a huge time saving. And they can do that safely and they can do it cost effectively.
Well, John, thank you very much for joining us and sharing that with us. That is our first flight review, hopefully the first of many. But thanks again.
No problem. It was a pleasure doing it. And let's hope we see some more in the future.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the Society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
And now over to Tim for our next X10, our top 10. Tim, over to you.
Okay, this week it is our top 10 dangerous airports.
Oof.
The criteria for this is not necessarily the most crashes or accidents or the most deaths involved on the runway. But we're looking at the airports or runways. When you see pictures of them, you just can't believe that anyone would be mad enough to land there. So, number 10, Tonkotin International Airport, Honduras. This 7,000-foot airport runway in the capital city of Honduras is in a valley and surrounded by high terrain. Despite this, the airport is served by international airlines, with the biggest airline operating there being the Boeing 757. Until 2007, there was a hill immediately before the threshold of runway 02, demanding pilots be at the top of their game. Number 9, Gibraltar. Dangerous crosswinds coming off the rock of Gibraltar make this an interesting approach for the unwary pilot. Plus, did we tell you there was a road that crosses the runway? Number 8, Ice Runway, Antarctica. A runway built of sea ice. This airport at the bottom of the world serves the US McMurdo station in the Antarctic. The runway is built afresh every season, and although it's able to support the weight of a large aircraft like C-17s and C-130s, special care has to be taken that the aircraft don't get stuck in the snow. Number 7, Bagram, Afghanistan. Flying into a war zone to deliver freight or personnel certainly classifies it as dangerous in anyone's book, as well as the threat from manpads, heavy caliber weapons, rockets or mortar attacks on the ground. There's also the crowded airspace with UAVs of all sizes mixed in. Number 6, Congonhas Airport, São Paulo, Brazil. An airport in Brazil, Congonhas, is surrounded on all sides by the urban metropolis of São Paulo. Its tight location and short, slippery runway has led to a number of accidents, including the last in 2007 when a TAM Airlines Airbus A320 skidded off the end of the runway. Number 5, Gustav III, or the third, depending on St. Barts. Not many airports require a pilot to crest a hill with a road with traffic almost on the threshold, but the Caribbean airport of St. Barts does. Pictures and videos online show aircraft like Twin Osters and Cessna Caravans shaving scooter riders' heads by feet. Oh, and the other end of the runway is the sea. Number 4, Tenzing Hillary Airport, Lukla, Nepal. Situated at 9,383 feet, this airport is a high-level destination for those travelling to Everest Base Camp. Runway is only 460 metres long and has a slope of 12%. With a mountain at one end, there's no option for go-arounds and a 2,000-foot drop at the other end. Number 3, Kai Tak, Hong Kong. It may not be closed, but Hong Kong's classic Kai Tak Airport ranks amongst the most spectacular approaches ever. With airliners landing close over high rises. The pilots of the runway 13 approach saw flying a low over a densely populated city to line up with a checkerboard marker on a hill and then a quick 47 degree right turn to land. From the photos, you imagine that washing lines and TV aerials were regularly caught by landing gear. Number 2, Princess Juliana International Airport, St. Martin. Another Caribbean gem, this is the Plane Spotters Beach Paradise where wide-body airliners appear to skim sunbathers' heads on the threshold to runway 10. The approach over water is also considered disorientating. And number 1 for our most dangerous airports is Corche Evil, France. More of a ski jump for aircraft, this amazing runway in the French Alps has an 18.5% slope and only 525 metres long. There's no go-around on landing, so once you're committed, you are definitely landing. Eagle-eyed movie viewers may remember it from Tomorrow Never Dies, where Pierce Brosnan's 007 hijacks an L-39 jet to escape from the bad guys. So that's my top 10 dangerous airports. So what do you think? Any I've missed out?
Oh, no. My son flew from Lukla last year on, I think, a Twin Otter, actually, whilst trekking up Everest. I have a fantastic photo he took from the mountain end of the runway looking towards the 2,000 meter drop. So I'll post that in the show notes. Gibraltar's an interesting one. Didn't think that would get in there, but the road crossing is pretty unique there. Any you can think of, David?
Oh, I'm surprised he didn't bring up Philadelphia International Airport, where we have where we have things like guys driving through fences and then driving down the runway. So, I mean, no, but seriously, a lot of those, I question the blue ice runway. That's pretty much, I mean, we've landed things like C-5s down there at McMurdo. So I'm sure there are other challenging ones. And Princess Juliana, yeah, that's on the bucket list. Any Av geek, you know. My wife likes the beach. I like the beach. We like drinks with little umbrellas. And the fact that it's right next to a major metropolis and I could have a 747 land on top of me, that's a good day, though I will not be one of the ones that is hanging on the fence while the if they're taking off in the opposite direction to hold on
to get blown into the sea. Yeah,
yeah.
You can see some of the jet wash of you know, people who get a little bit too close or you know and you know kind of get kind of you know end up in the surf.
Yeah, no, I definitely that. My Dutch heritage, I definitely have to go to St. Martin's at some point in my universe to sit on that beach one day and soak up the sun. And with my luck, it'll be raining. So, but that's that. But yeah, it's a good list. Anybody watches the old movie with Air America? With they do a lot of Pilatus Porter landing on runways that nobody really should be landing on, which really means you're just basically crashing into the side of a mountain. So there was a lot of that aerospace in the late 60s, early 70s. So those are always my kind of. If you have to use a Pilatus Porter, you know, it's a really bad runway.
isn't that one out of Air America where there's a Pilatus Porter landing on some kind of basically just kind of a ridge somewhere.
Yeah, basically they're crash landing into the side of a mountain and then they taxi down the ramp and you basically fly off the mountain or the mountain leaves you as you go down the hill. So. But yeah, interesting list.
So that's Tim's X10, our top 10. Let us know what you think about that list in our Get Involved segment.
Game challenge begins. Launch. Circular orbit. Rapid rendezvous. Intercept and dock with International Space Station.
All engine running. Lift off. Tower clear.
Push the ISS to higher orbit. Rescue EVA astronauts. Avoid space debris. Destroy debris with missiles. Protect the ISS. For as long as possible. Deorbit. Land. Survive.
All in a day's work.
We had a pretty large bank. We had a problem here.
Post control, both autos. These engines command override off.
We've had shutdown.
Leo, Low Earth Orbit. A game from SkyrocketCafe.com.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so to the get involved and feedback section of the show. In the last episode, Tim's X10R top 10 was, of course, 10 seaplanes. David, you immediately kicked off the feedback by saying number two isn't a seaplane, it's a float plane.
You know, and now that I've thought about it for a while, I'm and don't let either PCDU know or the guys at APG, but this is a historic moment. I'm going to admit I was wrong, and I'll tell you why. I said the Beaver wasn't a seaplane, it was a float plane. But it dawned on me that my favorite place at Oshkosh has beavers show up on floats, and that's the seaplane base at Oshkosh.
Yes.
And they call them seaplanes. So okay. I'm going to take
point
back
conceded.
I'm going to take back my. It's not a. It's a float plane, not a seaplane, and leave it at that. Even though the Beaver is at the top of my list. It's interesting that, but it is interesting whether you talk about float planes or flying boats. You know, I mean, if it lands on pontoons, it's definitely a float plane. If it lands on its hull, it's a flying boat, and what I always thought was a seaplane. But I'm going to stand corrected and say that I like the list. I like the Saunders Row. That would have been interesting. Or the one that I grew up looking at, which was the Convair Sea Dart. We actually had one at Willow Grove in our museum. So I grew up. It was a Hydra Ski. And I also had a Rex, a Japanese World War II aircraft, as well as an Arado 196. So that was what I was growing up looking at as far as famous seaplanes.
Okay, well, let's tell you what some of our other listeners had to say. Ian Kershaw said, once we've agreed on the difference between a flying boat and a seaplane, I would venture the following. Martin Mars water bomber, the Boeing Clippers, the Shorts Composite, the Spruce Goose, the Saunders Row Princess, the Saunders Row SR-1A jet-powered flying plane.
Seaplane.
Flying boat.
And I thought for one moment we wouldn't have many bloopers. The Saunders Row SR-1A jet flying boat, the Catalina, the Supermarine Walrus, the Vickers Vedette, and his last, by no means least, a vote for Grant's Lake Buccaneer. So that was Ian Kershaw. John McKilry said, well, I have to agree with the Catalina being number one. My late father flew them during World War II in number 6 Squadron, Royal New Zealand Air Force. I also remember seeing a majestic white Sunderland flying in the mid-60s. I would probably include the Shorts Solent on the list, though, and possibly the Grumman Albatross. Dave Homewood said number 10, Short Mayo Combo. Number 9, the Beaver. Number 8, the Boeing 314 Clipper. Number 7, the Short Solent. Number 6, the Short Empire. Number 5, the Supermarine Walrus. Number 4, the Catalina. Number 3, the Short Singapore 3. Number 2, the Sunderland. And whatever the heck this thing is, and I'll include it in the show notes, it's called the Atlantic Airways Flying Boat from 1937. And it includes a YouTube video, so you're going to have to go and look that one up. And finally, Bettina Chavan came back with any flying boat flown by Sully, which I thought was very good. But some interesting ones there that I don't recognise. I don't recognise the Short Singapore 3. That was a one that I didn't know. The Short Mayo Combo as well.
Oh, that was that. The Mayo Composite, that was one of those really how to find a solution. And you actually had a flying boat on top of a float plane on top of a flying boat. And the answer was to get the mail as they flew from Great Britain to the to Latin America, you wanted to get the mail there quicker than having the float plane arrive. So as they got close to the land, they'd launch the aircraft off the top of the other aircraft so that the float plane would get the mail a couple of day or so early ahead of the flying boat.
Wow.
So it's a short Mayo composite is definitely one of those ones that is a unique combination, but it's interesting history.
Yeah, no, good stuff. Thanks everyone for writing in on that one. And of course, do write in on Tim's X10 top 10 from today. And over to the last program's Pods Challenge, which of course was what aircraft and how many would your display team be? What would it be called if you had an open choice? That was a challenge that Amy set us. We had a massive amount of feedback, so I'll race through some of these. Amy herself said she would have 6 English Electric Lightnings, and I would call my team Team Stinger because of the Lightning's nose cones. Major Easy on Twitter said Team Tremor, and that would be 5 Vulcans. Catty Millmarker said Thor's Hammer, the Griffin, 7 aircraft, and that was easy. Richard Atme said I would call the team Merlin and we would use 3 World War II Spitfires. Just think of the sound. David, you said 4 C-130As and call them the 4 Horsemen, although J's could do. Isaac Alexander said 4 Martin Mars flying in a diamond formation doing water drops. They're just majestic. As for the name of the group, they'd be called Big Thunder. Gary Moore said 9 A-10 Warthogs, Team Tank Buster. Aviation Prince said 5 Chinooks, they'd be called Team Thump. Dave Homewood said 4 Mosquitoes and 2 Spitfire 9s called the Merlins. Jeff Kratzenberg said I would have 5 SR-71 Blackbirds called the Angry Birds. And then to wrap it up, a V-Force Rod came in with the Red Barrows, and I'll put a link to the YouTube video that shows what the Red Barrows were, but quite an amusing little group they were. So, yeah, some interesting aircraft in that mix. Love to see all of those, I think.
Yeah, Gareth, the A-10 demonstration team was called the Piglets, just so you know.
Really?
Actually,
I didn't know that. Our
Pennsylvania Air National Guard actually flew a A-10 demonstration team of 4, and their nickname were the Piglets, and had little pig faces on their on the front of their warthogs.
So, oh, gosh, how cool is that? Yeah.
We actually had the official A-10 demonstration team instead of the demonstration time, which was basically them doing a circuit and blowing up things, but and flying a couple diamond formations, and they were really easy to shoot because it really was a very slow demonstration team.
Yeah, great photos. Yeah, I'd love to have seen that. I guess we're just not going to see that sort of demonstration ever again. I don't suppose.
Not when we're going to retire all the A-10s by the next 2 years.
Okay, over to voicemails. Ian Kershaw from Calgary.
Yeah, it's 552, Calgary Tower, number 2, Vienna 37 on a 2 mile final. Breaking has reported fair. And climb Charlie 2 exit, wind 0606, quick land on my 35 left. Clear land 35 left, check fair. Is there an RVR? RVR is greater than 6,000 feet. The last arrival reported their runway in sight 1 mile and a half back.
Well, good afternoon, folks. It's Ian Kershaw here. It's Wednesday, January the 29th, over the noon hour in Calgary. There's a lot of snow in the air. Everywhere is white or a shade of grey. Not much in terms of taking any photographs, but it's interesting to hear them discussing the braking action on the runway and the visibility. Just wanted to say how much I enjoyed episode 22, particularly the article on the seaplanes. And funnily enough, when you were talking about the Sunderland seaplane, I heard this sort of raspy, rustling, sort of grinding sound. And I looked around. I was just getting off the train. I thought maybe it was something up with the train. But Then it dawned on me. I think it was the Sharp brothers and Arthur Gouge, the guy that designed the Sunderland, who were turning in their graves to hear the Sunderland classified as a seaplane. I know that there's some generic terminology here, but I've always thought that if it's big and it floats on the hull, it's a flying boat, and it's got a couple of big cans. If it's got a couple of cans underneath the wings shaped as floats, then it's a seaplane. Nonetheless, I enjoyed the article and wanted to say how much it stimulated some thoughts of mine. And in particular, I thought of the Saunders Row SRA-1, which was a jet-powered flying boat, which, although it looked rather ungainly, apparently its flight characteristics were pretty good. And then, of course, you can't talk about seaplanes or floats without reference to the occasional DC-3 that, oh, I think one of them anyway, was tested with floats. And being based in Calgary, De Havilland, Canada, Viking are putting together brand new twin otters, many of which go on floats. Ken Borax are based here for twin otters, and they use floats all over the world, including the Maldives. And in Victoria Harbour in BC, there's about 200 flights a day in and out of the harbour. All float planes, everything from radial engine beavers, turbo otters, twin otters, and the occasional interloper in the form of a Cessna on floats, but I don't think they really count. Favourites, top 10 favourites. I did wonder whether, well, I listened to an article the other day talking about the world's most beautiful sound. Then there was an online poll and tens of thousands of people took part, came up with the sound of sort of jungle and swamp noises. It did sound quite nice. I wonder whether we should be looking at what would our 10 favourite aviation sounds be? Would it be the voice reminding the Airbus pilots to pull up, pull up? Would it be the sound of a radio batting past, pulling a Grumman Bearcat, or a symphony of four Merlins? Might be an interesting conversation. Just wanted to say how much I enjoy the show. I look forward to listening to the next episode. Thanks to everybody for all their remarks and contributions. And I'll keep an eye on the movements here at Calgary for the next few minutes while I have lunch before I go off to my next task. That's Ian Kershaw in Calgary signing off. And once again, thanks, guys. Appreciate all you do and the contributions of all your other participants. Oh, and Grant didn't do too bad either, did he? Filling in for absent friends. And, of course, I join everybody in wishing Steve Vischer all the very best and a steady, if not quick, recovery. Look forward to him back on the show shortly. Take care, guys. Bye now.
Thank you very much for that, Ian. He also sent us a couple of emails. First email says, I guess with names like North Caribou Air, Canadian North and Yukon, they'll expect some snow every now and then. And he's put a link to some of the pictures of aircraft that he's seen at Calgary. I particularly like the 757 photograph, which I looked up and is actually an ex-British Airways, an Air Europe aircraft, and I probably would have seen that almost 30 years ago. Still looks good, and of course those RB211s do make that awesome noise. Ian's second email said, I plan on sending a couple of pictures to Mike Mullane. This is following our Riding Rockets interview that Gareth did for us. He's read it again for the second time and it's addictive. He's now about a quarter of the way through Vulcan 607 and he says Roland really has captured the can-do spirit and just what a close-run thing it was. So thank you very much, Ian, for all of that feedback. Over to Twitter. It was a very busy month, so I'll try and get as many of these mentions in as possible. This is Katie Rose. Thank you very much for the shout out that Aviation Extended are really pro helping young people to get into aviation. Also mentions there for Get Into Flying and Global Aviation Resource. We got a mention from CP Flight Log. So too, Stephen Taylor wrote to us, said, loved the latest edition. Really enjoyed enjoyed the new top 10 feature. So many top 10s to go through. And a mention from Mike Sharp. He said there's a documentary on the double sunrise flights mentioned in episode 22, and he's put a link, which I'll put in the show notes.
This one is fast. Maybe we hit a rabbit or something else. Left hand side.
Thank you. The Orchard 72, wind 040 degrees 4 knots, runway 2 clear for takeoff. This is 1885, all good so far. Crash 93 Hotel, wind 0, correction, wind 330 degrees 3 knots, runway 14 clear to land.
Good land, 14, correction 93 is on.
And did you get the information from the previous server?
Yes, copy that. 93 is off again.
Okay. This is 1-0-4 Kilo, target 18 Fokker 100, line up 2-8 behind.
Good arm behind the Fokker 100, line up on the 2-8 behind, with 1-0-4 Kilo.
Tower, Lorient, this is 1-8-7 Juliet.
This is 1-8-5 Tower, Juliet, cross runway 2-8.
Juliet, cross runway, this is 1-8-5, and 4-in-4, it was probably a Fox on the one-way.
Okay, we'll check the runway and we'll let you know. Airport authority will visit you at the parking. And 1-2-1-7-5, goodbye.
So now we're 1-8-5.
This is 4-1 Hotel, wing 0, 40 degrees 5 knots, runway 2, clear takeoff.
Clear takeoff, runway 2-8,
4-1 Hotel.
How good to know, this is 2027, I have a small four.
2027, time routes, your final approach speeds, and continue.
Final approach speeds is 2027.
2027, an Airbus landed 2 minutes ago, reported a animal hit, maybe a fox on the runway left side, so we'll check it this time, keep it rested.
Approach is 2027.
Over to promoting aerospace and promoting your websites and blogs. And in this episode, we're promoting Neil Graham Photography. Neil is a great supporter of the show and he's promoting Extended on his site. He sent us his top 10 aviation photos of 2013. They're on our Facebook page. But do have a look at his website and do have a look at his photography. It is high class. My favourite is P51 Nookie Bookie, which is coming into land with the Canopy open, and we'll put a link to that. A mention as well for Air Smolik. Libor Smolik, a good friend of the show, has very kindly supported the show on his website. He says, I'm currently about to finish my ATPL, and after that, we'll have a more interesting time to come. I think he means finding a job. He's got a new blog, and it's not very heavily content rich at the moment, but he does have some interesting links in there, one of which is that he believes listeners may be interested in is the old vintage Czechoslovakian twin Aero 145 that he restored a few years ago. So I will put a link to the website showing that aircraft. They're flying at air shows around the continent quite often. Maybe we'll get to see it here in the UK someday. But anyway, you can find Air Smolik on Facebook and Twitter as well. And some of you may already have seen some of his photographs, which are a little bit racy, but a great sight. So thank you, Libor, for promoting Extended. So every episode, we give away a copy of Doug Worrell's book, Dragons of Thin Air, designed to help those 1 in 4 people afraid of flying. And this episode, it goes to Ian Kershaw, who, of course, sent us the earlier audio message. Now, we don't think that Ian will need this himself because he's just off to Hawaii with his wife for a well-deserved break. He also told us he'd be flying Air Canada and a 767. So if you want to tell us where you're going in the world and what by what aircraft type you're flying, then of course get involved at aviationextended.co.uk. Now, to be in with a chance of getting a copy of Doug's book, the higher qualifying messages we get are the audio ones, followed by messages about your need for this book. So it's pretty easy. Just write in to us or leave us an audio message and you will go to the top of that queue. Thank you very much to Doug Worrell again for providing these books for our listeners. If you want one, you can, of course, buy a copy through our Amazon link on the website. So finally, before we go, Tim, do you have an aerospace topic you'd like to promote?
Yeah, there's something that popped up on the web or Twitter recently. about the project to restore a flyable Westland Wessex helicopter to sort of fly and display circuit in the UK. You know, those of a certain age will remember the you know, the sort of sturdy Wessex, you know, helicopter that looks like it's made out of you know, kind of iron, the big chunky sort of wheels, you know, great machine, and yeah, it'd be great to get a you know, an example of those flying perhaps on the display circuit. So for more information, go to Wessex, www.wessexhelicopter.co.uk, and you can get involved there.
Okay, thanks for that, Tim. David, do you have anything you'd like to promote?
Oh, well, you guys are going to have some interesting events this summer with the anniversary of D-Day. So I know Canadian Warplane Heritage is sending over their Lancaster. So you'll have two Lancasters flying. That'll be really cool.
Yeah.
And there are going to be a couple of DC-3s going over, C-47s going over to reenact the parachute drop. So it'll be interesting to see all of the commemorative events for D-Day that you guys are going to get to see that we're not privileged of seeing, or I can't afford the pocketbook to go over there and witness. But
yeah, but I haven't seen the Blue Angels yet, David.
Oh, did I mention growing up they showed up every year?
It's on my bucket list. I did send you a copy of my watch. I do have the Blue Angels watch.
Yeah, no, the Angel. Well, you know, and I was lucky enough to see the Red Arrows at Langley Air Force Base in 2010.
Yep.
And you guys are really lucky. It what was interesting was my friend just sent me a picture of one a scan, and his comment was, you know, I think they're better than the Blues and the Thunderbirds. And I kind of agree that your Red Arrows are pretty awesome. And it really was, it was nice to be in a position where I got to see a flight demonstration squadron where I didn't know the routine down to the second. The Blues and the Thunderbirds, I could blindly walk through the whole routine and tell you what's going to happen next. The Red Arrows, the day we saw them and them flying with the F-22 in formation, it was a pretty good day. So you guys don't sell short your Red Arrows.
No, they're a great team. I grew up with them, and I did take them for granted. And then 4 years ago, I went to Farnborough and saw them again, and they just blew me away. So, yeah, very proud of what they do. But the Blue Angels are still on my list.
I think that's a sort of a danger of everyone with that their kind of home team, isn't it? You know, you always think, oh, yeah, you know, the Reds or you know, the Thunderbirds, you know, they'll be there for, you know, keep on there. They'll be there around next year and the year after, and we learned
an important lesson last year because we lost them here. So, I mean, I still have to give the best part of the Blue Angels happens to be Fat Albert, and that's my dream ride. Is even though I don't have JADOs anymore, I'm hoping that this year maybe I'll score a flight in that there Blue Angel, my all-time favorite number one aircraft, which was 9806. Which was the original Fat Albert. So the Blues have a C-130. Nobody else in the world has it. So I got to give them the leg up on that one.
Okay. Then finally, before we close this segment of the program, we've got Amy's latest Pods Challenge. So I'll just play that.
Hi, Peter, Gareth and Tim. It's Amy. I have a new Pods Challenge for everyone. Firstly, I'd just like to thank everybody who got involved with the last Pods Challenge. I was absolutely floored by all the responses. I don't think I've ever read that many before. So thank you to everyone who got involved. This episode's Pods Challenge is a little bit of a follow-on from the last one. And it is, if you had your aerobatic display team, you already have your name, your aircraft, who would you have fly those aircraft? be a new pilot that we've never heard of. We could be someone we have heard of. Anyone. So, I'd like to know. Keep up the good work as always. And I can't wait to hear the responses. Bye.
Okay, so that was... she does manage to throw us off a little bit. I wasn't quite expecting that. Who would you like to fly them? I got to say, I'll kick this one off then. David, we've had, last year we had an awesome Typhoon display pilot. He just blew us away. I think I'd like to see him go on to display. I think he's going back into a squadron, isn't he, Tim?
Can't say for certain.
Okay. Yeah. All right, okay. I'd love to see him perform again. Very, very unique displays that he put on. Also, I mentioned earlier, Bruce Dickinson, who we know flies an awful lot, lead singer of Iron Maiden. He'd be an interesting character to have in a display team.
Oh, if we're going that route, I know who I want to add to the list.
Go on then.
Harrison Ford. He can ride shotgun in. if we're gonna talk about the my response, which was the Four Horsemen, back in the day, my father's unit for one air show, actually in C-130Es, they did perform the whole Four Horsemen display, right? And unfortunately, my father's base commander got in real trouble because you're not really supposed to do a level bomb burst flying over the audience and doing the break just for the audience. So if you can imagine four C-130s coming at you in a diamond formation and doing a level bomb burst across the field where two pull vertical and then break left and right and the other two break left and right, it was a pretty amazing display, and I'd go back in a heartbeat to see that again, see that display again. But Harrison Ford would be good. He can ride in the back.
Yeah,
he can sit next
to me. That's a good one. How about you, Tim?
I think I'm going to have to reach into the past there and plumb for father and son team of Ray and Mark Hanna. Much missed on the historic Warbird circuit. Those pair, They sort of top of their game. So if the realms of sort of fantasy and fantasy sort of display teams, getting Ray and Mark Hanna to fly.
Okay, so if you want to tell us who you think should be displaying in your display team, hashtag Pods Challenge, email us or drop us a line on Facebook. Okay, it's time to wrap up for this episode now. We would like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions, and of course to Doug Worrell and Basic Six for supporting Extended. We'd also like to thank Amy Parkin for another Pods Challenge. And David, thank you very much for joining us today. Hope you've enjoyed yourself.
Oh, it's been great. And you guys, we're all one big family, so it is kind of fun occasionally to commit podcest, as I like to call it. it's fun being able to talk about stuff we don't touch based on Airplane Geeks. You guys do a great job. And
thank you very much.
We are one big family, and it is really good that I have met lots and lots of people because of podcasting. And I regard Peter, even though you got to get over here some point, we definitely and regard you as an important asset in Airplane Geeks. And Tim, I love had our conversations that we've had on Twitter. You know, you keep me challenged as far as my military av geekdom. I got to keep up to date, even though both you and Gareth, and I was really expecting grief from him. You know, we're not happy about my comment about, so what's so big? What's the big deal about a typhoon?
Oh yes, I forgot to include that in the show notes. So I think we'll probably have to get Gareth here back on to defend that particular one.
I'll need to get my abuse. He'll have to get my abuse in on that one. So, but thanks for inviting me, and I hope you'll have me back at some point in the future.
Absolutely, yeah, we will. Absolutely, we will. Okay, show notes for this episode with the accompanying pictures and links for the topics we've covered will be found on our website. That, of course, is aviation-extended.co.uk, as well as our Facebook page, all one word, Aviation Extended. You can follow us on Twitter as Aviation Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. Tim, where can we find you online?
Yeah, sure. I'm on the website is www. Is that the right number of W's? That's three W's. Aerosociety.com, and you can find me on Twitter at RES at RES Timor.
David, where can we find you?
Well, every Wednesday, Airplane Geeks come out. That would be airplanegeeks.com. And on Fridays, you can hear me and Max pine about UAVs on the UAV Digest. But if you want to reach out to me, the best way is to find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, VanderHoof. And say hi.
You can find me, Peace Johnson, at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk, as well as facebook.com/xtpmedia. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from David Vanderhoof.
Thank you, and goodbye, folks.
And it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everybody. Yeah, see you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. And remember to stay tuned into this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
This is XTP Media.